My name's Paul. I'm an alcoholic. I got an illness. I don't have a fever, but I have an illness. Something I never did before is giving my date. I get a few numbers out of the way here, which I've never done before. I had my last drink on the 28th of January, 67. My first AA meeting was on a Sunday night, at Sunday night as this group here. And I've been coming in and out of here for a long, long time, this meeting. Part of my fellowship, one of the AAs, because as you all know, there's two AAs, you all know that. And then there's another group. I belong to the Downtown Wednesday Noon group that will be celebrating 33 years at the end of next month on the 25th. So you're all invited. And by the way, this is Montreal, just in case you're out of town. And then watch it when you come in, because we nail out of towners. The format at Wednesday Noon was based on the mustard scene in Manhattan. Speaker, and then discussion on step. I was 3 or 4 years at that time in AA, and was running around a lot of meetings in Manhattan, having a grand time sobering up there. And I had been asked to form a group down at Benedict Labra House, and I did, and that's where Wednesday Noon started. This was 1971. End of August, 25th, 26th of August. By the way, that is the best group in the world, because I belong to it. And I'll throw something else that's very good that I have never mentioned before. I'm the founder. And I say that in all humility, because, and things went well for years and years and years and years, because I ran the show there. There was no discussions. We had a couple of people that tried to take over, blah, 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 but then they got fed up arguing, so they moved on to bigger and better things. But I stuck around because I had nothing to do on a Wednesday. It started at 9 in the morning, and then we moved on to later on at noon, and we're still at noon, and we're still at St. James the Apostle, St. Catherine and Bishop. Well, that's great, the higher power using this bird here to get a group going, hanging in there for all these years. It's not a hanging in, it's just part of my life, and just enjoy going there and coming here, part of the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, because if anybody needed Alcoholics Anonymous fellowship, it was me. More so than anybody else I have met in the program. We call that being exceptional. I'm different. Well, I certainly was. I'll try to touch on briefly where I came from when it comes to emotion-wise, drinking-wise, adventure-wise, and the illness full-blown. I had my first drink. I was around 18 in the Army. We were training to go overseas. This is 1940-something. And by the way, I'm an old man. Right, I think I'm 78, pushing on 78. But all you girls, I say that because there's only a couple of gals here. I rarely say that at meetings, because they look at me and then they wave pop. So my love life has gone down the drain since. So I stopped giving my real age. Though I'm in pretty good shape yet for an old Irish bozo. I had my first drink at 18 in the Army. I still remember what it did to me all these years later. And that went on for a long time. And I was down in DeBert, Nova Scotia, ready to get on the boat in 1945. And the drinking wasn't out of hand then, but I enjoyed it immensely. It loosened me up and things functioned better. And happy with the world. I was in the military. I loved it. I did it. They gave me a couple of stripes, unconfirmed stripes, the buggers, because when we transferred, they removed them. I didn't like that. But back to the drinking. It's 1945 and the war stopped in Europe. I remember me and a couple of other guys were very, very disappointed, and because I was looking forward to getting on the boat, going across the trip and across the Atlantic and going to England. I had an aunt Margaret in Dublin, in London, a whole bunch of Irish ancestors and old uncles in Northern Ireland where we can get in and out of, and I was there as a kid. Went to school there when I was 8, 9, 10 years old. I wanted to visit them again with my grandparents. So when that war stopped and they canceled all these transatlantic crossings, I was very disappointed. Nothing to do with killing or blowing up people or blasting things all to hell. It was me, my trip. I was overtrained. I wasted a lot of time in the army getting to where I was, and the friggin' thing stopped. Very disappointed. So we all got drunk, and I remember drinking in the wet canteen in De Burt, near Truro, and going down to Truro and continuing our drinking there all night and buying pigs and having a grand time. Came back to Civvy Street in 46 and then had a grand time doing all kinds of adventures, like getting a job, a wonderful job, and then going for a drink. The job, the wonderful job I had, become unimportant, and I went for another drink. Why I went for another drink is because I liked it. I liked what it did to me, and it was doing it better than it did when I was telling you getting the good times down in the Burt, the first drinking sessions. Now I was drinking because I liked it. It was doing something for me, full blast. And it really went along with how I saw the world. The whole world was mine. But the trouble started is when I kept forever running out of money. It's a hell of a thing, you know. If you think you belong to, if I thought I belonged to the jet set. You don't have an airplane, and it was before the jets, and you don't have a dollar, but you have a name that has a certain amount of value around that area in the township where I came from, and forever playing on that family name. After a while, people sort of, oh, you're so-and-so's son, yeah, yeah, yeah. And by the way, how's my credit? I did that for how many years? 46 to 1950, been all over the place, worked for an insurance company, sold cars, and traveled North America, worked in the mines and the wheat fields and the oil wells near Edmonton, helped build Clover Bar Refinery, and all that had a pattern. I mentioned dollars a while ago, and I didn't want to be forever broke. I'd go at a job, pile it up, come out, go to the tavern like in Edmonton, a bunch of the guys sit there and go like this. And whatever bundle I had stashed away for dry for a couple of months, it went. It went along with the high swinging and the living and the squalls and the gambling and the whole thing and living at the hotel up there, had a room there by the week, and enjoy life. Came back to Montreal and was on another bender down at the Queen's Hotel, and I remember coming out of it there one morning and went down to the tavern and I met my friend Johnny Gern, a member, and I'm shaking in the tavern. It's the 12th of June. It's the 12th of June 1950. Nothing any different than but I still lived off my parents more or less, and they lived in the townships. And Uncle Mike was the manager of the Queen's Hotel. That's not the big one here now. It's the one down the hill in Peel. A nice old Irish hotel there. I had a few connections there. And we're in the tavern. I'm shaking. It's about 9 in the morning. My friend Johnny Gern came in, and he saw that, and he spiked my two drafts. when he had a Mickey, he pulled it out, and he knew what the problem was, and he had the solution. he didn't have the problem, he didn't have the program of action, but you see, he knew what the hell my problem was, and he knew how to solve it, and that was to give it a couple of spikes in a rye and beer. And it did. By 10 o'clock, one guy bends over, and he heard us talking, and he had a Gazette, and on the front pages of the Gazette, Canada goes to war or some friggin' thing against Korea and has been attacked, and we're looking for volunteers, and the Royal 22nd Bandus, my regiment, is looking for volunteers for the war to go to Korea to represent the United Nations. I had about 6 drafts by then, by 10 o'clock. The shakings had stopped. I'm only a young fellow. And I see this and give it a bit of a think, thinking like, geez, terrific. My regiment, I'm in between jobs, I've got nothing to do, and the contract is for 2 years more or less. Perfect condition. Travel, expenses paid, they give you booze, cigarettes, and then besides that, they feed and dress you up. I mean, what the hell more do you want for an active alcoholic? And a healthy one, too. Away we go, for Christ's sake, and excuse me for the adverb, he's my higher power, by the way. I get him into the act now and again. We're training in Truro, in the other end of the world. We're training in the big camp outside of Seattle, Fort Lewis. We're training 5,000 Canadian brigade there because you have nothing that big here in Canada. So they trained us there, got on a boat, and got off the boat in Busan in South Korea. I remember that morning. I'll never forget that. It's before first light. We're moving in this huge trooper, I don't know, 8,000 troops on board. We're moving in slowly at 4:30 or 5 in the morning, moving in to the waters. And up on the bow, whatever they call that part of the boat, the front part, and I'm looking over there, and I'm looking down at these little fishing boats with the little lanterns, and they're bobbing away, and I see mountains that look a bit like the Laurentians, and it's dark, and there's a funny smell coming from the land, and I'm saying, what in hell am I doing here? I'll never forget that. What am I doing here? Passing thought, get off the boat, and then we moved up to the front lines. I was in the infantry, and I was a private in the infantry, and we did what privates do in the infantry, and that is dig a hole in the ground, hang in there until they come at you or until you get an order to go after them. That is basic infantry. It's not very complicated, and get your head down or otherwise the other guy down there may blow it off. Until in the Canadian Army, they give you a ration of a great big bottle of beer every day, and it costs 10 cents. And if I was 2 or 3 weeks, 2 or 3 days, maybe a week, and I didn't get my ration, or I sold it for cigarettes, or exchange for cigarettes, everything was all right. I was friends with the captain's Batman. They called him the Padre, and he had the job of distributing the booze and the liquor. When I mean liquor, the best. Johnny Doers, Johnny Walker, and all those, nothing but the best. My buddy would sell me the bottle at 10 bucks. And I would make contact with the 1st Marine Biv. Hope there's no Yanks here. Over on the left, and I'd sell it to them for 20. But once if I didn't open the bottle or crack the first beer, it was all right. If I cracked the first bottle of beer, I didn't know anything about the illness except that once I cracked the top and bloop, 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 it went down there. It did to me what it does to all alcoholics. I was nowhere halfway through the bottle, but I wanted another one. And I didn't give two hoots in hell what those guys down on St. Catherine Street wanted to blow my head off or not. Didn't care nothing. What I did is, we had walkie-talkies, but what I did do is get some guy over there to line up and fix it up and get more booze in there and some, oh, we had Korean young fellows, we had geeks or gooks or workers. So we'd send a couple of gooks down there to haul up more beer from Fox 2 and bring us in, and we'd have a party on the front line. Let's get out of the war zone and let's really go into the war zone. That war scene did not scare me one bit because I'm an alcoholic. I function on fear since I was 4. So fear has not formed to me, or discomfort in the head, or all those malaises that me as an alcoholic lived. Nothing strange there. Nothing strange about being fearful. What was strange is when that disappeared and I was drunk. That was odd. That I didn't. And these other guys, my friend, one night we're even have the front line now. My friend, forget his name, what the hell is it? J.P. Collins. Blew his nearly his head off. Should have been. In a dugout in there and going and crying and yelling and this and that, and the guy became shell-shocked. Our own artillery was coming down on us. I think the Americans, the American artillery was supporting us. We wanted them to go away. Please go home. We will settle it with our 24th Armored Brigade. We will handle our artillery. Major Castle, British. Then you got the Australians, the Canadians, the Indians, the Turks, and get them all together. Then we moved as a division. Things moved then. I got out of that war, back on the civic street, and I'm not well. I got a few thousand, nobody that I know, maybe a couple, that you can hear about. Coming out of the army, I got $3,000-$4,000 stashed away on account of the bootlegging and the this and that. And when we didn't, we went to Japan, we went to Korea there, we went to Tokyo for about a week, and I only blew $700 or $800 during that week. And I'm talking about 50 years ago. More. You blow $800 in a week in those days, and we're like, Christ. Anyway, I'm back on Civvy Street in Granby and Montreal. I'm not in a hurry to find any kind of a job, though Pop did get a little worried after 2 or 3 months of me having a good time and playing, you know, all that. And I was self-supporting, but I still had money left. I'm a calculating alcoholic because if I have 100, I'll go out and blow 20 tonight, and then I feel happy and secure because I know that I got another couple of 20s and to keep it up for the rest of the week. That's the way I function. Not saying that I didn't blow at all when I really took off. I want to touch on something that I very, very rarely do because it scares me a bit to go back to that area. I did that once in all my travels in AA, and I did that once in Rome, an AA meeting within the walls at the Presbyterian church within the Catholic Roman, and I give that talk there once. And people began to fidget and walk because the other guy ahead of me, there were two speakers. I don't know why I say this, but anyway, there was two speakers. The first guy that spoke in that Rome meeting was an engineer, big shot, big wheel, flying Rome, Montreal, Paris, and all that, and New York, and he'd give us the uppity uppity. So I'm sitting there, typical alcoholic, thinking, I said, yeah, that guy's full of bullshit. I'm going to give him the exact opposite of what he just did. So I went into the real emotional, drunken depth of my suffering. And that is, in my father's home, I had a little apartment downstairs, and they let me come and go as I want. And I did. I took advantage of those good people and their freedom they gave me, and I did. I would leave that little pad at night to go out and drink and come back maybe, depending how much cash I had, whenever I come back, maybe a day or two or three, or maybe the following night or the following day, wait till the sun goes down and go behind the big house my father owned and into my little hole in the ground. What I went through there emotionally with the shakes, the self-disgust, the shame, the guilt, and the withdrawals, they didn't know what the hell was going on there, but I knew. I knew. I would leave that place. I mentioned that over at a meeting there the other night. I would leave that at 4 or 5 in the morning. If I had a beer or two and I couldn't sleep, I could not sleep as an alcoholic. I went down that 2 drafts and I have alcohol. I couldn't sleep. What I would do is, instead of lying in bed and trying to sleep, it's 4 or 5 in the morning, it's a beautiful summer's day, I'd put my little old comb and razor blade safely in the hip of the pocket, and then, but I'm flat broke. You don't go too far when you're flat broke. At 5 in the morning. I'd go up and swipe $5 out of Pop's wallet, look around and this and that, and I was going to take it, and then as I'm leaving the back of the house, who's coming down around the house is the milkman. Well, I hit him for $2, and I'm up to 7, and I'm not having left. I'm walking down Drummond Street on the street I was born, and I'm going around to turn, make a little turn, and I run into a guy that owes me $2, and he paid me. Now here I am. I am as happy as a bird. Those loud birds in the morning that used to disturb me no end. Especially they start chirping just outside my window, and I didn't have a gun. I turned that one in. I thought that it came to mind that, hey, Paul, you're barred at the local hotel. That hit me. That hit me besides the suffering and everything else and the shaking and what. And I just don't belong anywhere. I can't go back to my favorite watering hole. Can you imagine? No problem. No problem. I got $9. Just go down that way to the local hotel. No, no, make a left, go down to the highway, the Waterloo highway, and I go out there and start hitchhiking down to the Waterloo. Got a lift down to the Waterloo Hotel, I go around the thing, entrance to the, it's only about 5:30 or 6 by then, and I knock in the back of the hotel room, and the guy goes like this, the night cleaner goes like this. He sees who's in there, he goes like this. The thought came to me, I says, I hope to hell I'm not barred here too. Because I had a tendency to tell the people off in my controlling modes and this and that, and sometimes I spoke too loud, and sometimes I told people where to go and they didn't want to go and all that kind of stuff. So you get the picture, a loudmouth little drunk trying to run the world. The guy let me in and he says, he used to call me Mike. Hey Mike, come on in, but be quiet. And there, so we're in there, and off we go again. I remember with that $9 when I left my home with the shakes and the shame and everything, by the time I got the first big bottle of Bolton down into me in Waterloo National Hotel, notice the Waterloo Hotel, plug commercials, I think they're all torn down now. It's a shame, all those beautiful watering holes. I'm that drunk, I landed up in St. Benoit's Yacht, my old, with the Benedictine monks, 3 days later, drunk out of my mind. It's the sun's coming up, and a buddy from Magog drove me there and dumped me on the front lawn of the Benedictine monks in St. Benoit's Yacht. I'm having a grand time. I think I had a couple of bucks left, and I hit LeClaire. He had a big restaurant, he used to go to school room. All these guys are loaded. I'm the only one with this broke. There's no justice. That's the way I thought. I come out of there 3 days later, sobered up there, came back to Granby, saw my father. Pop was working around the lawn. We're getting close to AA. Working around the front lawn. He's retired by then. And he sees me. The guy that drove him back to Granby was a writer for the Gazette or one of the French newspapers. He had just lost his job, so he was done to me. Anyway, dropped me off in front of the house. I get out of the car. And Pop sees me and he goes, I always thought he was praying for me. No, you don't. You know, when you watch people, when you're talking to somebody, guy goes, watch it. Anyway, back around the corner into my little hole, my little pad on the back of the house, and my brother Sean is there. The firstborn. The guy without a drinking problem. The guy, the extrovert. I'm the introvert with a drinking problem. And getting better at developing the problem. Not only that I did not fit into the world, I was an error. And I was ashamed being part of this whole bloody world because what's going on there? Only booze could wipe those feelings out. And I wanted more, and I didn't know that I was allergic to alcohol, and I didn't know this mental obsession. I didn't know anything about that until I came to AA and started working the other AA. Two AA. Fellowship, and then the book. That's the other AA. The solution. Pop decided, him and Sean, and Mom's, I love Mom. I hear my father saying once, sitting on the back porch and I'm downstairs trying to come to, and I hear my father saying, what are we going to do with poor Pa, Ma? Ma says, oh, don't worry, Pop, Dad. The good Lord will take care of him. Well, that sort of knocked the wind out of my poor Irish Catholic Roman alcoholic father. I mean, he didn't know how to handle that. This was basic, bottom faith. The real McCoy. Pop had the activated worry sort of wart. And he worried about worrying, and he was a practicing Roman dogan. Two days later, they had decided that it'd be a good idea if I had not worked for 4 or 5 years then. They decided it'd be a good idea if I came back to the city and live with my brother Sean. I did. On the bus back, and Sean, I said to Sean, you know, I hate everybody in Granby. Sean was reading. He's an avid reader. He goes, why? I hate everybody in Granby, including the mayor. Poor Robin. Then goes up. You're all good guys. Why do you hate the mayor? I says, I didn't want to open up to him too much because I opened up to you guys. Because I went into his office once about last year to hit him for $10, and I'm half pissed. And he said, no. And he said, go on outside there, Sean. I'm Mike's son. Go on outside there, Paul, and down around the back there and get the other door. And I said, maybe they'd give you a bit of a hand out there. I don't do that in the mayor's office. So I hated him ever since. Which is normal. So how are you going to do? I came back to Montreal, had taken a verbal pledge for 30 days from the Benedictine monks. I wouldn't drink for 30 days. It's fantastic. And I didn't. Moved in with Sean during those 30 days. I got two jobs. I got a job, hadn't worked 4 or 5 days. The emotional situation was sort of, I wasn't a basket case, but I was right on the edge of being pushed into it, you know, looking at that basket. Just about, well, you can call a basket case. Let's go call the shots what they were. I got two jobs. I got one washing dishes at a company down, and I won't mention it, big outfit. And I got another job selling the Gazette, prescriptions for the Gazette. That's quite a combination. And I stayed sober for 30 days. I was happy doing it. The first paycheck from the dishwashing thing, I put half of it in the bank. There's a bank near where I live, in Shawna. And then I made a few bucks selling the Gazette, the prescriptions, the Gazette for $1 a shot. And not too bad, not too bad. If you're going to mouth off, kid, mouth into this thing here, maybe you make a sale, maybe you make a dollar. And I made a few bucks. But the part is about selling and working for the whoever the hell was contracted out to sell for the Gazette des abonnements en France, the subscription, is that I'd be, after the 30 days I went for two beers at the Weimar Tavern on Dominion Square, and I started to back into the pattern again, because I had a few bucks in the bank, secure. I'm well, I've arrived, I got a couple hundred in the bank. Up comes the allergy, it was a long weekend, and this and that, and I get drunk. What happened there is I lost both of those high-powered jobs. But during the time I was drinking and still working and selling for the Gazette, they didn't know they had a superstar there. But I'd be up at the Berkeley Hotel, my favorite, one of my fancy drinking holes. I'd be sitting there at the bar, lovely, at the 5 or 6 o'clock shadow hour, whatever the hell you call it, and playing the wheel. Not the gambling, the big wheel. I've got my pinpoint suit on, and never dressed leisurely. I mean, anybody dressed leisurely, you're a bum or you're out of work. There's a guy sitting next to me, and I knew to see him. And Bill, the bartender there, he's a good fellow. He gave me credit up to $2. And the guy sitting next to me says, "Hey, Bill called you Mike. Well, what do you do for a living, Mike? I see you around here quite a bit." "Well," he said, "you know, I'm a ghostwriter for Fitz, the columnist." The guy looks around at me and he says, "Oh, that's terrific." He says, "I didn't know my father had a ghostwriter." And then he got up and left. Now, I never really found out who the hell that guy was. So I suppose there were two con writers and two bullshitters sitting there having a beer, and who would come up the other. Not very long after that, I had moved out of there, got my own apartment, and the wheels fell off that. I'd lost two jobs between that time, the pearl diving, the phone work, telemarketing, and I got another job in a large department store, night maintenance. And I lost that degree. At the end of my rope, just about, I discovered that I couldn't function with people and I couldn't hold on to a job. But then again, the thought came to me, "But you did pretty good, Paul, when you didn't drink." I have a little apartment, a room with a stove, fridge, and a little bed on Mansfield. And it's 5 in the morning. 6. Cold as hell at the end of January. I had 2 beers in the fridge, and I drank both of them. I got up and got dressed, and I'm going to go down to the cathedral. I was there tonight, saying goodbye to the old bishop that kicked the bucket there the other day, an old friend of mine. And I got dressed and went down to the cathedral, and walking up and down the vestibule, and I was about to receive an extraordinary gift, and that was a gift of a state of powerlessness. The thought came to me that, "Hey, Paul, every time you take a drink, you get into trouble." I said, "Right." "And every time you get a job and you go for a drink, you lose the job." I said, "That's right." "And when you do save a couple of bucks from not drinking, you go for a beer, and whatever the hell you got to pay the rent, it goes." I said, "That's right." And I'm walking up and down, and all this great revelation, biblical terms, I'm being revelations all over the place. And I had my 2 beers about maybe an hour and a half ago. By this time it's about 8:30, correction, 7:30, quarter to 8. And I agreed to everything that came on the mental screen in regards to alcohol. That's right. "And besides that, Paul, you have a difficulty living and you're not getting along too well doing that. And whatever stability you got when you're sober, which is very minimal, that goes down the drain when you have a beer, and you're totally out to lunch. In that state of powerlessness, the higher power decided to move in with his power. What he used is this. He used the power of example. He used the power of example of two men, two buddies that I drank with. One was Jean from the hometown, and the other guy was John, a friend of the family. His father was my godfather, a very, very close knit, and he was 10 years in AA. They were always in my mind, these men. The one in Granby, John, he had a beautiful big lady shoe store, and I used to hit him for the odd deuce. He'd give me a big smile and a big handshake, and he'd make me promise that I wouldn't spend that $2 on crazy spending, and now you just take care of yourself. Never mentioned drinking, boozing, AA, or anything. But I knew that guy had something that I wanted. That morning, I knew these two guys were in AA, and I am going where the two Johns are. And that is who AA. So I made a decision that morning not to give up booze, not to change all this and that. I made a decision that I'm going to that outfit, the all thing, and that's where I'm going. I didn't go into the church that morning. After that great revelation that probably took maybe 5 minutes or whatever, I left the building. On the way out of the building, there was a man coming in, and I spoke to him because he was all dressed in black, and I thought he was some kind of a priest or rabbi or whatever he was. And I admitted to this man, complete stranger, "Guess what, sir?" "What?" "I just discovered I can't drink." He gave me a funny look. I did not know what the hell I was talking about, but I knew. I just realized a few years later that I just admitted to another human being that I can't drink. Cut across the park, went by the tavern. I didn't go in. I had a thought, maybe I'd go in. No, Paul. You have $5-6 on a Saturday, you can't get drunk anyway. And the banks were closed. The Nova Scotia at the corner of Peel and St. Catherine, Nova Scotia. I walked by the tavern and went up and had a cup of coffee at Quirk's drugstore. Now the little girl helped me find the number of this alcohol. I couldn't find it. I'm shaking and this and that. But the miracle, the craving of alcohol, and full blown the whole thing, mental, emotional, the whole system has been alkalized. Trigger, the allergy, the obsession, we're all there full blown. When I left the building, went across the park, looked at the tavern, no, I'm going over there. The craving for drinking was removed. That's a miracle. I have alcohol in my system, and the craving has been removed. Myrtle. Fellow, that's a miracle. Scientifically proven, miracle. The phenomenon. On the way from the church to the Peel, the coffee shop, there's something there that I learned quite a while later after studying the book and hearing tapes and everything else, is that why the craving was removed. And I never said, "I'm giving up booze for life, but I'm going to 30 days. No, there was none of that. I just admitted I can't drink. Big, big, big difference. I'm in a recovery outfit and I'm not going to drink one day. That's not a, hey, that's all. That's, I don't know what they call that. On the way from there to there, I said to the conclusion, I came to the conclusion that I don't want to be that way anymore. That was the Christmas wrapping paper that went around that wrapped up my powerlessness. I have faith in that outfit where my two Johns are, and I made a decision, that's where I'm going. 1, 2, 3. I got the Sunday Nighters, this group here at the YMCA, and I said that to somebody, and he says, God, he says, what's your name? Mike. Hey, Mike, he says, you're terrific. He says, we've only got 12 steps, for God's sake, and you got 2 or 3 of them done already. I didn't know what he was talking about, but I liked it. And he said, another guy says, now, don't take the first drink and you'll be all right. Mike. I looked at him and says, what do you mean by don't take the first drink? I just finished telling you that it damn near killed me, and the suffering and the emotional instability, and I told you about nearly getting plugged in Korea because I was half pissed. Because I put my head up and I shouldn't, and I should have been there. Sort of, and you're telling me don't take the first. I don't want the first drink. Here, have a cigarette, light it up, go sit down. And hold on, I'm going to get you some literature. You know, keep coming. Not a light. The guy said, keep coming back. Beautiful, because I'd been barred at the Copacabana, and I'd been barred about 3 places down. And I walked out of that Sunday night as with an old member. His first name is Bud. And he helped me out. He helped me in the door, and he helped me and went for coffee. Peel, St. Catherine, and we could not find a place for a coffee at that hour on a Sunday night. There was no McDonald's, no Burger King's, or no nothing. I'm talking about 37 and a half years ago. A couple of guys walked me home, and this and that, and I'd lined up Mondays Central and this and that. And I started to do extraordinary things like going to bed sober, getting up at, 8 o'clock, shaving, combing the hair, and working on the want ads because I was out of work. Looking at the want ads, well, what kind of a job do you want, Bob? That was confusing. Are you going to go into sales? You're not a salesman, but you're an alcoholic, and you love people, but they make you nervous, and you're afraid of people. I mean, that doesn't make a top-notch salesman. I agree to that, too. And then I got a job as a night maintenance man cleaner at a big department store to an AA member. Good old Gus. He died. I love Gus. Well, there's my boss is looking for a man, and I did. I got a job, exactly what I needed. There was only a little crew there, at about 8 of us, night work, and not too many people, not involved too much, going and this and that, and work from, I don't know, midnight to 8 or midnight to 7 or whatever the hell it was. At least that 8 years. Happy as a hoodah. Happy. I'm making about $50 a week. My attitude was this. On this $50 a week, I'll be able to become self-supporting, I'll be able to pay my little room and my own board, do my own cooking, and I'll be able to go to these meetings and get well on my 50 or 60 a week or whatever that was. That's the attitude I had towards coming to the fellowship. Amazing. Old-timer says, Eddie McCaffrey, every time I go into that building that I told you about there, the church, I think of Eddie. The founder of Eddie's Follies. He sort of adopted me because I was Irish, I was Roman Catholic, and I was from the townships. And I knew this old Father Jesuit down there. He was sort of running the parish down there where I came from Loyola. A good old Eddie, he'd be sitting up near the in the church there, and he's doing some 11-step work. And in his prayer and meditation, and he's a high power nervous Irishman, aren't we all? And I've got about a few months in there now, under a year. And I'd see Eddie sitting over there. That one up there, Eddie! He jumped this high in church, scared the hell out of him, coming out of his meditation and prayer. Never get these men. Meet him on the street, he'd give me about 30 seconds. Hello, Paul, how are you? And this and that, he'd keep on going. I was nervous, and he was nervous, and that is about all we could handle. I was doing something right. I kept going to Alcoholics Anonymous. I kept going to meetings. I got into the book. I started writing history of this guy here. I wrote the fourth step, the history of this guy here, and didn't learn a thing. Until I found out that, hey, Paul, why don't you do it the AA way? And I'm not going into the steps. Have no fear. Wind that up here in a few minutes. Then I discovered something extraordinary, and this is more profound today, and I've been working on that with the tapes and higher and the big book. And there's revelations coming in. So I'm getting to know this guy more so now than 30 years ago, 25 years ago, 10, 20. I didn't realize the importance of doing it the AA way in regards to resentments. The columns. You've all heard of the columns, but few people have heard about the fourth column and the importance of both. Okay, I hate my old man. Why? Well, he preferred my brother to me. And what happened? I get mad as hell. I want to shoot everybody. And Paul, what about the fourth column? Well, what would you do? I mean, could you be a little kinder to your father, a little more tolerant than this and that, and blah, blah, blah. Fourth column. I didn't look at that one too much. Then I discovered that a lot of my coming from, affected by my father's drinking at five, we won't go into that, but a lot of my isms are shame-based. They go way back as a little guy, growing up. When I said that I was working in fear and in a state of perpetual war, and I was in a war, I right about right at home. But I didn't know that it was shame. I didn't know that it was shame-based. Changed the whole ballgame. I mean, Paul, you got nearly 100 years in the fellowship and you're still getting pissed off and you're still going around, people are pushing your buttons. I mean, let's take a look at the buttons. I did. Still working on the buttons. Find out with this man, I discovered that a lot of it is shame-based. And I discovered that in depth in another fellowship. French. Thank God the old man sent me to a French school. Great revelation. I love the other fellowship, and I won't talk too much about it, because the girls there are prettier than the girls in AA, and they keep going around and hugging us. They're all dying for affection, and they're hugging us because they've all been hurt and wounded the same as me. Without the drugs, without the booze. I had the drugs, the booze, and the lack, and nobody loved me, and I'm an heir, and all that. Paul, come down and sit down here. You feel right at home. Second fellowship, about a year and a half ago. Turned me right on. Go about a couple of those meetings a week in French. And now that has been fulfilled. Isn't that the higher power still running through here? I am getting better. And I'll tell you why. I'm letting God be God. Is that something? I call him Abba. And Daddy. I could never call my father Daddy. My five sisters all call Daddy, and we all love Daddy. Mike and his five girls and Granby. Christ, that was the head of the town. Mike and his five. Pop would be down at the tavern having a grand time getting half gas. Mike and his five girls. Well, the youngest of those five girls, winding it up, Kathleen, she's in the Granby Hospital now. I was up to see her Wednesday and spoke to her this afternoon. And probably got 2 or 3 weeks, maybe a month to live. Cancer of the lung, and she's on the edge. And a whole bunch of visitors and all that. And I said to my sister Kathleen this afternoon on the phone, I said, Kathleen, I love you. Automatically, she says, well, I love you too, Bob. I only said that to Sheila before she went off. And she had a drinking problem. Kathleen doesn't. And for me to say that to another, especially blood relatives, is a bit difficult. I never said it to my father. I never made up with my father. because we're both alcoholics, both same temperament, and we could not have got closer if we both lived to 100 years old due to the temperament. I'm winding up. Kathleen, when I was down to see her Wednesday at the hospital in Granby, and there's a bunch of nieces and nephews around there, all around the bed. God, visiting, all that visiting killed me. Anyway, she handled it very well. I says, Kathleen, Kathleen was the favorite. She got the house, the whole thing. Kathleen, what did Dad think of me? A bunch of nieces and nephews, they all stopped talking and getting the answer. I wanted to find out. She said, Dad was afraid of you, Paul. That sort of bit of a bump there. I didn't react to that. No comment on that statement because there was nowhere to go with it until I met some elder people in the fellowship to enlighten me on that statement. And somebody knowing my father is that he was alcoholic, he was insecure, top salesman, insecure, fearful, and to unwind he'd go for a beer and get drunk for 3 months. I was the same way. When we got together, he triggered my insecurity and I triggered his. That's why Papa and I can never get along, no matter who we lived through. But my brother Sean, the opposite, they were hugging and this and that, and you know. But I could do that with Mom, not with Pop. They never seemed to help me see that. Also, okay, Paul, you're coming in for a landing, is that the man, what I'm trying to describe here now, is the man when I was 4 or 5 years old, he'd have a beer to unwind after coming back from the store Christmas Eve to unwind, and he'd say, Ma, I think I'll have a beer to loosen up. I'm in the living room with 2 or 3 of my siblings, and I'd freeze. I still remember that as if it happened yesterday. Because I knew the man that I loved as a little guy, when he got drunk, and everybody was in the house, open house, baseball players, hockey players, everybody was in the Mike's house, and I lost my father, the man that I loved. And where do you go when you're 4 or 5 years old? Don't know what. This is what part of the shame-based thing and the difficulty of me getting close to a man. But that is healing, and it is healed. And I can't handle it. But I am willing, ready and willing through the love and the power of my higher power that exists in me. And I sort of loosen up and let him handle it. And to bring in a little spirituality, I have known ever since I was a little guy, my Kathleen says, it's fun. And I taught spirituality to Kathleen. And she's in her dying bed. She says, you know, Pa, I regret that there wasn't more spirituality in our house. That was a shocker. Because Mom and Dad prayed all the time. She says, where the hell did I get it? I get it when the monastery is when it's half drunk and said, I'm Benoit Rougemont. This girl telling me, I've discovered that who's going to do the healing there is my loving higher power. And I'm letting him touch me. And that is happening. All that was sobriety all these years later. And I'm still around. And I haven't cracked up yet. And I think I'm getting better. There's one thing that I do see and admire is all your tolerance. And I thank you for it.